everybody, please be seated. I'm going to give a case of the 59897, the R-14 versus the court, the plaintiff's Paradise Court, Homeowners Association, Thompson, for the petition, legal, for the real party interest, destruction.
Your Honor, I please the court. I ask you to reserve 10 minutes for the public hearing. And this particular bit provides a recurring theme for some others have been arguing recently before this court, but also some new issues that I'd like to highlight for the court here. The first is the dearth of any evidence that was presented to the trial court to allow that court to do a Rule 23 analysis or to determine the standing. As this court said in True Sight, there clearly the obligations of the trial court is to determine which of the defects exist, where they exist, what theories of liability are available to the homeowners, and what would be an appropriate compensation for that. In this case, at the trial level, there was no expert reports provided. There were no evidence of any kind provided there, other than a few pages from the CC&Rs, which demonstrated one fact very clearly, which is that the Homeowners Association has no obligation to do repairs, maintenance, or otherwise interact on the exterior surfaces of its triplexes. The units, 245 in total, encompassed by 114 buildings, are owned individually by the homeowners, and the CC&R provide that the individual homeowner has the obligation to maintain these areas that are being sought by the Homeowners Association as a subject of this litigation. The Homeowners Association, in their various briefs, admits that this is not a condominium project. They admit that this is not a typical, as they put it, or historical type of class standing, and that's because they want this, but then they go on to say that this court and the trial court should analyze this as though it were a condominium project because historically these surfaces have been maintained by the homeowners associations or condominiums. As a result of that, they want the court to basically ignore the only fact that was in the trial court, which was that these are not maintained or subject to maintenance by the homeless association, except in the circumstances where the units have deteriorated to such a degree that the association has the right to come in, do repairs, and impose upon the homeowners the cost of those repairs. We have a situation where there is nothing in the trial court that this court can rely on to provide a Rule 23 analysis because nothing was identified. The only thing that was ever talked about was an oral argument during counsel for the Homeowners Association asserted that they were merely seeking the building envelope, which he defined as the stucco walls, the penetrations to those walls, including windows and doors and other things that may extend through the stucco surface. They agreed that they don't, the association, has any obligation to do anything to those services. They also agreed that the homes are owned in fee and that they're individually held, not tenants in common as in some other cases. As a result of this, they embarked upon an interesting analysis, which is adopted by the trial court, that the homeowner's individual rights should be transferred to the Homeowners Association because they're in a superior position to assert those rights and they were in a superior position to effectuate any necessary repairs. They argued to this trial court that there was, in fact, an impact upon the common areas because all of these units would potentially affect the value of all the units combined. There was no evidence for that, nor was there any citation to the authority. What we had at that point then was that there was no claims being made as to which defects were alleged, how often they occurred, if they occurred in every building, any building, what the defects were, And the result of the argument in the trial court was that the homeowner association said, well, we don't have to show that because a defect by its very nature doesn't have to be defined, all it has to do is be identified. A defective wall is a defective wall, no matter how it's defective. That would seem to go completely against the analysis that this court required in the first slide. This court was very clear that the homeowner associations had standing. We're not disputing that they have standing. What we are disputing is that they failed to provide any evidence to the trial court as to their required analysis. And then the trial court decided that the analysis was not required in spite of this court's direct statement in the first slide. And came up with a conclusion, which was Exhibit 8 of our opening brief, that the analysis required by this court was no longer required because no money was going to go to the homeowners themselves. That the homeowners themselves, in some fashion, not cited to either in the moving papers below or in the court's order, should be divested of their rights to repair or to do anything about their individual units. And any money from defects in their homes should go exclusively to the homeowners association, who, because of their fiduciary obligations, were in a superior position to effectuate those repairs. The fact that there is no support for that in the record and or case law, I think speaks volumes about the conclusion reached by the trial court. The trial court appeared to be struggling with what was conceded by the homeowners association that they did not satisfy Rule 23 analysis. They said that in their briefs below, and they said that in their briefs to this court. As they call it, a traditional Rule 23 analysis, they did not satisfy those requirements. So the trial court then fashioned its own process, which was that even though this is not a common area claim, since the damage awards will not be distributed to individual unit owners, there is no requirement for a Rule 23 analysis. And the guidance provided by the Schutte case is not applicable to this type of case. That appears to be completely opposite of what this court determined in First Part 2. It also appears to be a divestiture of the owner's rights without any due process, and it also places my client in a position where they're subject to multiple claims for the same defect without any remedy. What the trial court has done is said, well, the homeowner association can bring a claim, and they get to keep the money, even though they're acting in representative capacity. And to me, that would be the same as saying the class representative and the class action gets to keep the money because they're in a superior position to effectuate the repairs. That seems to be the only justification provided by the trial court, and I would offer to this court that it's not acceptable nor consistent with the jurisprudence of this state court and other. What was raised at this court's level was whether First Light 2's requirements for a Rule 23 analysis and applying the strictures applied by Schutte is a constitutional violation of the due process of equal protection rights and the separation of power rights from the due to the association. My review of the underlying motions indicates that was not raised in the trial court. It has been raised here, and if the court's going to consider it, I'd like to address that for a few moments here.
Yeah, I never asserted that. We knew that just when it comes to record. What were, what was the specific relief requested of the trial?
That the association has standing to bring claims on behalf of its members.
All right. We talked about Rule 23, we did not talk about 116.
That's true, Your Honor. And I believe that 116, 3102, 1D, as this court indicated that they had standing. I think as we talked about in the past, and I believe brings up some detail, is that gets them to the courthouse door. It did not then move them into a position where they can assert claims for all the individual homeowners, absent some type of protection for my client, which this court, I think, afforded by saying that they hadn't been through a Rule 23 analysis.
Well, the Rule 23 analysis, though, as to how the trial would proceed, proceed as a class action, or we proceed as the individual units belonging to a holder, but the association still represented. Agree with that?
My impression of...
Because it's not necessarily, the lawsuit is not being necessarily brought under 23.
It's definitely not being brought to class action.
That they've not come in as a clarification as to how do we proceed at the time of the trial.
I think that's a fair statement, Chester, and I would do it because my impression was that they were, the question the trial court was, we have standing under 116, therefore no other procedural requirements are being put upon us to allow us to bring claims on behalf of all individual homeowners, even though we as a homeowner association concede we have a peer obligation. This is not a common area, and the owners have exclusive rights of obligation to attend.
Of course, my real question is, if you deny 23, are they still not left with the 116 rights?
They are with the 116 rights, which to us gets them in the door, but it doesn't allow them to bring claims on behalf of all individuals.
Well, when they're asserting that they don't have the 23 rights, then the 116 rights evaporate and we just kick them out of court.
No, they're arguing they don't have standing. They don't have standing for us. They can bring the rights on behalf of two or more that affect the common area. These don't affect the common area because they are in fact
area of common interest.
That's correct. It's common interest. And then I guess I'd like the court to consider, and I would have to consider at that point, what common interest is being affected and what evidence there is of a common interest impact. By defects that one cannot identify, and two, we can't tell what they are, where they occur, if they occur, and to what degree they occur, which was the analysis of this court said that the trial court had to do to allow them to come forward and make these type of claims.
I think what you're stating to me is that there's no ruling as a 23, there's no ruling as a 116 application.
Well, the ruling was in favor of the association we had in standing. My recollection is that the trial court said they didn't have to go over the 23 losses because no money was going to the individual homeowners, which to me is like, I'm taking away the rights of the homeowners, I'm going to give it to the HOA, and I've got no basis for that other than 116 says they have a right to come into court. 116 doesn't say that they have a right to come into court and keep the money, it says they can create on their behalf. That to me means that they are acting in a capacity that allows them to bring the lawsuit for a benefit of the individual owners, which to me means that the money goes to the individual owners at the end of the litigation. That seems to be the opposite of what the trial court said in the basis for the ruling, saying that Rule 23, I think the correct answer to the court's question would be never ruled that Rule 23 was satisfied, but your rule was Rule 23 was not necessary. The constitutional issue that was raised by the Homeowners Association in their reply brief raises two issues of which I'd like to address briefly. One is equal protection, the other is the separation of powers. They first off say that this court's interpretation of the statutory scheme in 116 is a violation of the separation of powers. They cite no cases that support that, and the long history of the courts judicial opportunity to interpret the statutory schemes seems to go against them. The period of their argument was that this court had made an unconstitutional ruling that limited the statutory rights of the Homeowners Association granted by 116. I think that analysis is kind of the opposite of what the analysis should be, which is whether the legislature acted improperly and this court found that they acted improperly. It hasn't been raised here at this point, so I'm not sure it's really right for this court to consider, but it appeared to me that the argument that this court can't interpret the statutory scheme goes against the very settled law in the United States that this court's duty and obligation is to interpret the statutes. The other one's on the equal protection argument, and I think they concede in their reply brief that the rational basis test is the appropriate test for interpreting guessing they're not interpreting this court's own decision, which I found to be unique in the analysis that they were going to say rational basis does have to apply to the Supreme Court's decision. Therefore, I struggled with the response to that, but the bottom line was that if they're saying that the analysis provided by this court is a violation of their equal protection rights, then they would have to at least indicate that they're in some kind of protected class to make it on a national basis. And at least seem that they would be established that way in the country. As a result of that, I'm hearing that this court should spend a great deal of time on the constitutional issues raised in the reply and not raised in the trial court. And I see that my time is up. I have any questions reserved.
See any questions?
Mr. Carlson, I'm going to give you 3 minutes in rebuttal, and Ms. Mayfield, I'm going to give you 18 minutes. You'll have 3 minutes for rebuttal. Since you want 10, right?
That's a key issue.
Thank you.
Chief Justice Cherry, Justices of the Court. A couple of things I want to clarify. The association is not going to take any voice here to go to it's trying to exercise their statutory right to represent two or more homeowners on matters affecting the common interest community. We're not trying to deprive them of anything. We're trying to help them in connection with this case. Now, our position is that, reflecting on the court's ruling here, is that early on in the first, like, two arguments in briefing, there was no significant briefing, and there was no request by D.R. Horton that Rule 23 should be grafted onto and become a limitation upon statutory standing conferred by NRS Section 116.3102(1)(d). No request for that. Rather, D.R. Horton argued in front of this court at that time that the units themselves, separate interests, were not part of the common interest community. And if they were not part of the common interest community, then defects within the units could not affect the community. After a really careful review of the entire statutory scheme of NRS 116, which we know was put in place to create, to manage, to operate, to fund, and maintain community associations, this court determined that indeed separate interests, the homeowner's interests, were in fact part of the common interest community. And as part of the statutory scheme, the legislature with NRS 116.3102 had given the association the standing to institute litigation anytime two or more homeowners were involved in the matters affected the common interest community. The court properly concluded the defects within the separate interest, the units, the homes of the homeowners did in fact affect the common interest community. Thereafter, this court reviewed some secondary authority, that being the restatement. Now, it's interesting because I think you have to put the restatement in historical perspective. The Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act, which originally published Section 3-102, dealing with the standing of associations to bring claims on behalf of its members, was published in 1982. In that document, there was no mention of Section 3-102 having to comply with Rule 23 or with any class action principles. Never mentioned. Now, the Act was revisited in 1994. Again, this section, 3102, was published without any reference to Rule 23 or any requirement of class action prerequisites having to be met before an association could sue on behalf of its members.
That's our point.
Yes.
This seems to be the rule that seemed to go awry in terms of bringing in claims versus matters of proof. And isn't our distinction that 116 allowed you to bring the claims, that 23 is just a method of how you're going to prove up those claims?
Not as applied in this case, yes. As applied in this case, it's being used as a sword by developers to keep, kick us out of court. We've been given the right to institute litigation. Now they're saying, since the claims we want to bring for the exterior building envelopes cannot be class action prerequisites, we should be back out of court. These are not common areas. These triplexes are owned in fee by the association. So here, it's not really a matter of proof. And the proofs that they request would actually be a full-blown trial before we ever got to go forward in discovery and trial to prove up our prerequisites under Rule 23.
And we just assumed we found in this hearing that the individual units were owned in fee by the unit owners.
They are owned in fee. By the unit owners.
Not by the association.
Not by the association. But what the Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act, and subsequently Nevada's adoption of that act in NRS 116-3102-1D, was a recognition that if they wanted to give the association standing to sue on behalf two or more members on matters affecting the common interest community, regardless of whether or not the association had any ownership interest in the property. And historically, in condominium cases, where the walls and the roofs, et cetera, would be common areas, the association has no ownership interest. The homeowners are tenants in common, and each owns, for example, in this case, a 1/345th of all of the common area. Here they own 1/3 of their building in fee. And the homeowners association, like in condominium cases, has no ownership interest. And getting back to the adoption at our legislature of NRS 116, at the time they adopted section 3102D, they didn't add any limitations to it that required the prerequisites of Rule 23 to be met. Now, ordinarily, I think we all operate under the assumption that the legislature wants to limit, place limitations upon the statute, it can do so and it will do so in the statute. And in fact, in this case, if you look at the statute, limitations were placed on the association's power to institute litigation. First of all, it had to be a matter affecting the common interest community. And for ages, until this court ruled in First Light 2, developers argued that the units are not in the common interest community. They're completely separate. So the association can't represent them at all. This court properly determined that was not true. So here, if the matter affects the common interest community and it involves two or more homeowners, they have to satisfy those two limitations. The association has standing to proceed with the litigation, to defend, institute, et cetera, litigation on behalf of its members. I didn't have that standing before. Now, that was in 1991. That section has subsequently been amended in 1999, 2003, 2005, and 2009. And not at any point along the way did the legislature see fit to impose any further limitations along the lines of having to satisfy the Rule 23 prerequisites of numerosity, commonality, typicality, adequacy, predominance, and superiority. It could at any time, had it so chosen, further limited the association's right to proceed, but it chose not to. That was 1991, all those chances to amend. Subsequent to the adoption of the statute here in Nevada, the restatement, third, the property servitudes, came out with its comments concerning an association's standing under Section 611. But that was not until 2000. So it's clear that the restatement certainly is not approving anything. And it's clear that the legislature and the body that adopted the Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act could not have considered the restatement or any comments associated with it. Now remember, the restatement is a survey of common law, of case law, law developed by bodies like yourself, by the courts. It is not a survey of statutes. And the restatement and its comments in connection with Section 611, talking about standing of associations, is careful to point out that in the first instance, states look to their express statutes to determine things. It's only in this, if there's no statute, do they look to the case law developed by the courts to determine what the rule would be. Actually, the restatement observed that because of some early cases which block an association's right, I think down in Florida, to bring a lawsuit on behalf of its members, and gradually the legislature started to change that, Florida did, and also case law started to change. It started to recognize that with regard to associations in the absence of a statute, if either a member or the association had standing to bring an action, then the association had standing to bring it on behalf of itself and on behalf of its members. Here in Nevada, we have a statute which expressly provides standing for us. Now, this court, this Florida court, has not hesitated when it saw, after further briefing and argument, that a mistake may have been made, or that a case it had published is causing confusion in the lower courts, which I believe anyone in this room clearly admit that the decision in First Light 2 has done. We have multiple different iterations of when the association can proceed on behalf of its members coming out of the state court. And I believe nearly every one of them has ended up here before you, ladies and gentlemen. It is our position that looking at all of these factors, it would appear that First Light 2 was decided incorrectly, that attaching or grafting Rule 23 requirements. What the court said was that the trial court had to look to see that the claim brought by the association satisfied the requirements of numerosity, typicality, adequacy, commonality, predominance, and superiority. Satisfy that. No wiggle room. The last direction in the First Light case was to the trial court was to make sure that the association's claims conformed to the principles of class actions and shooting to determine whether or not they could proceed. Well, if that's what you have to look at to determine whether or not they proceed, then clearly if they don't, the association's claims can't satisfy those prerequisites, then they're thrown out of court. And that's exactly what the developer D.R. Horton in this case is trying to do. We may be in the door, but now they're trying to throw us statutorily, but now they're trying to throw us back out the door because all of our claims can't meet typicality and adequacy in particular, because the claims of the association are never going to be the same in these cases as the claims of the members. We're never going to have exactly the same interest. We're never going to have suffered the damages, etc. So they are trying to throw us back out the door. We believe that if Rule 23, which the trial courts have been requested to follow, determining whether an association can proceed, goes forward in a traditional analysis, that it will clearly abrogate the rights that we have under the statute. And that's going to be a violation not only of the Constitution, but of NRS 2-102(2), where you have a procedural rule abrogating a statute. You know, the legislature has plenary power in the state to determine what the standing of an association is. We know that this court has the full authority to determine the procedures under which the claims they have standing to bring will proceed. But if the operation of the procedure abrogates or abolishes or eliminates that statutory right, then that's when it becomes a problem and violates 2-102, separation of powers.
So from your position, this is kind of a gift. This is more of a help.
Well, if it's just about how it's going to be tried, then, and it doesn't abrogate the association's standing, in other words, we can proceed with these claims for the exterior building envelopes, we're going to have a procedural rule that says, here's how we're going to proceed procedurally, then I don't see any constitutional violation of separation of powers or due process or anything else. But as it's being argued and applied here, it would aggravate it. Remember, this court said...
That's not the point that a claim is resolved, either for or against the homeowners association. To me, there is an intersection with the power of the judiciary insofar as that affects claim and issue provision on the homeowners claims. Because you have the homeowner association and the homeowner claim. Both of them, if they have claims, the homeowners have the fee simple absolute title to these walls, or to the ground on which the walls are erected. So, if the homeowners association goes forward and loses on summary judgment, they fail to prove out the defect. The homeowner later sues and says, my wall is affected. But what impact does that prior adverse determination have on the homeowner's subsequent claim? You hope the homeowner doesn't have class representative standing.
Under Five Star, this court's decision discussing issue and claim preclusion, the homeowner's claim would be precluded if the association lost. If the association won and for some reason failed to make the repair, so the homeowner decided to bring their own claim, that claim would be precluded under either issue or claim preclusion. Now, remember that NRS 116 is a comprehensive legislative vehicle as to how to manage these associations and operate them. And it speaks volumes to the rights and obligations that flow between the members and the association. And the association has a fiduciary duty to do what's fair and right and proper on behalf of its members. And if it brings a lawsuit with regard to obtaining money to repair defects inside units, then it has an obligation to make those repairs. And remember, there's a very broad statutory scheme of alternate dispute resolution in NRS 116, and it deals with the right of association members, if there's a dispute, to go to the ombudsman, to go through to the Department of Real Estate where they have an arbitration program, or to go to the Commission on Common Interest Communities to resolve disputes, all for free, and all before they ever have to go to litigation. So there's a huge legislative statutory scheme out there as to how the association, the members of the boards, interact and manage themselves. I would agree that the court could take some control and make sure that the money's going to the right place. Here, Judge Earl properly decided that the money would be used by the association to make the repairs to the exterior of the building, to the exterior building envelope. And historically, in condominium cases, that's exactly what has happened. I personally have not seen any instance where the association didn't make significant repairs to the interiors and the exteriors of condominium association. You cannot recall a single instance where a homeowner has called me from to take the board of directors of his association where we represented them to the ombudsman or anyone else for that matter, and wanted to know if they could bring a lawsuit instead of that to get their unit repaired. When you start imposing the prerequisites of numerosity, typicality, commonality and adequacy, you're going to run into the shooting situation, which this court, I think, properly observed that most instruction defect actions are not going to be appropriate for class action treatment. And that's because of the numerous differences that may occur between one, particularly that was a single family home case, between one single family home and another. Recall, Schutte, Common Interest Communities was never mentioned, was not involved. And NRS 116-3102 was never mentioned. Thank you very much.
Just a couple of things.
concerned about representations made in the court, because of things not in the records, so I don't want to go into detail. To me, it's a case of the opponent where the exact thing you were describing happened, which was home association settlement when you got sued by homeowners. So I'm sure there's many that come back from that particular instance. But really, what we're facing is this. These cases are highly expensive, as courts are aware. They're highly complex, and the sooner that everyone knows what's being claimed, what can be made, what claims can be made, and what the scope of those claims are, the easier it is to deal with the claims judicially and from the party standpoint. The association doesn't want to investigate claims they can't pursue. My client doesn't want to try to get ready with a claim that is going to ultimately be thrown out after trial starts. The issue that brings to this one is procedurally interesting. They moved, they had standing. They didn't identify which claims, but they wanted an early determination as to what standing they had. It was the same from our point of view. We want to know early what they can bring, what that procedural mechanism is, what the extent of their claim is going to be. And we're searching for, and we thought the first slide had determined, how that procedure can be effectuated, which it is. They're going to have to come in and say, I have these 30 claims. 28 of them, I think I can qualify under Rule 23 analysis for registration to shoot. If they can, they should make that representation. Their trial court, see if it's joining a chamber. But no, at the end of that year, maybe they have 27 claims, maybe they have 3 claims. The issue, though, that I think is being confused a little bit is that these claims don't disappear. The homeowners still have the claims, even if the homeowner association doesn't have the claims. When Mr. Mayfield uses the term me, he means the homeowners association. The homeowners are still available to make the claims. So if the homeowners association doesn't have standing for a particular item, it doesn't mean that there's no remedy available to the person who owns the claim, which is the homeowner. They can come into court. They can come in and join their action. They can do things if they wish to. They can also be free of not having things done to their property they don't want done to their property. As a result of that, I think the court has to consider that we're looking for, and we believe gave us guidance under First Light as to how this procedural mechanism, so we can find these claims early, save the judiciary its resources, save the parties their resources, so we can make a determination. Saying that you can pursue the claim, but we're not going to tell you what the scope of the claim is, puts us in a situation where we don't really understand what we're going, and it's going to cost us a lot of money. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chief, for your arguments and the briefs and the matters and submission and the briefs and the